This is the Preservation Technology Podcast, bringing innovation to preservation. The Preservation Technology Podcast is a production of the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training, a unit of the National Park Service. I'm Catherine Cooper. I am here with
Gilroy Chow. I'm currently the president of the Mississippi Delta Chinese Heritage Museum, a retired engineer.
I'm Freda Kwan. I'm the vice president of the Mississippi Delta Chinese Heritage Museum, and I'm a retired librarian.
I'm Carolyn Chan. I was born and raised in Greenville, Mississippi. I'm an elder among the group now, and I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I have been a classroom teacher.
I'm Randy Kwan, and I teach at Hines Community College in Pearl, Mississippi, and I teach film and TV production.
I'm Emily Jones. I'm the archivist and the curator for the Mississippi Delta Chinese Heritage Museum.
There are many stories to be told, and there are many ways to tell it. To do it with an oral history, with a video, with pictures, written, just so many different ways to archive and capture the information and to share it.
And I think that's what we need more and more of today, is for people to come to a museum such as the Chinese Heritage Museum in Mississippi, see that history, and understand that we all have had to go through struggles. We've had to overcome a lot of discrimination, and that we have to understand how each of us have a history that certainly deserves respect, but we also need to respect everybody else's history and work together to make this a better country.
What's really actually helped that blossom has been COVID, because people have been at home looking for things to do, and they've actually discovered more. I would say there's a greater awareness of the various cultures and the struggles that all the cultures have had to go through. And I really think that's actually kind of helped. I've seen to see that with my students a little bit. Much more sensitivity towards various cultures now.
One that really has stuck with me since it happened was when we were up there, I think it was November, when Madeline and your son and his family came.
Shannon from
Tokyo. And they were on the third floor, and you were standing in front of the picture of your dad as a young one. Mm-hmm. And you were telling Shannon and his two children the story of how your dad had come as a paper son. Mm-hmm. And how one day your name was this, and then it was a different thing. Mm-hmm. And what that meant for your dad to admit that. Mm-hmm. And record it officially and all that. And just to watch Shannon realize how close he was to what the 1882 exclusion laws had done.
Right.
As a national thing, it had an effect on him. And just watching you tell your son that.
Okay, all right. Because I have grown up sons now. One is 50-something, and so this son is like 40-something. He wanted to bring his children, Madeline, who is 20, and Jackson, who's 15, I guess. It was the first time. He wanted to bring them to Mississippi. We don't tell our children. So I grew up with, because my dad was a paper son, so I'm a paper daughter. So half my life I was Freda Pang. And then it was not until
you were in school, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so then we can change our name.
And he took the proper took their real name.
Real name back. And so,
rather than the paper name.
Some people did it, and then others were scared. I mean, to this day, they think they're going to get deported.
Because it happens.
Under today's, looking at what Paper Son created, you would say that there are illegal aliens. But that's the way the system worked in order to come to America. Because the law had created a system that was the natural reaction.
Because of the end of the Transcontinental Railroad, you had all these Chinese on the West Coast. And the West Coast said, we need to stop these because they're taking our jobs away. And so the 1882 Exclusion Act said that, they can come. Will allow 105 families. The only time an ethnic race was specifically excluded from immigrating to the United States. You had unlimited Irish, unlimited mm-hmm. Germans, unlimited Europeans, unlimited Asians, as long as they weren't Chinese.
Right.
Chinese were excluded. And the only time, and it wasn't until 1942 into the war,
43 finally,
the Magnuson Act corrected that wrong to not exclude. But not only men in 1882, but a couple of years later, the women were excluded. Mm-hmm. And so the only group that was excluded, so therefore the only way you could come in was if you were a
merchant.
Paper son or a merchant. And so my birth certificate says my dad was a merchant.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what is a merchant in 1940? But it was a class that could immigrate legally.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though he was a teenager, he was a merchant. Also, 1906 in the earthquake, if you were here by birth, so what year were you born? 1906. Where's your birth certificate? Oh, the earthquake got it.
Yep.
So I don't care how old you were, you were born in 1906,
yeah.
would be a way of getting in. And so we can look at it now as they were being clever, but that's how bad things were in China with war, famine,
mm-hmm.
Economic hardship. There was no place for them
to survive.
Home,
yeah.
To mm-hmm. actually survive.
Yeah. And so paper sons and paper daughters was a thing that happened, but it wasn't just a thing that once happened. It created Frida.
I mean, it affected many families.
And if your dad hadn't done what he did mm-hmm. at the time that he did it, you could still be a paper child. If he didn't go to the agent up in Memphis and do the things that you had to do to prove that you were worthy of being a citizen, even though you had fought in the war, and could you please, sir, have your ancestral name back? He did that, so you married as Frida Sue and not Frida Payne. And
then she's able to share it with her children.
Yeah.
The Gonalums, their daughter, Martha and Berta, they were in the schools in Rosedale, Mississippi, at the white school, and they were told after they'd been going to school there that they would have to leave because they were not white.
This was in the 30s, correct?
No, 1924. 1924 is when they filed it, and it went through the Mississippi courts, local courts or the county court. And then the people there, they said, well, no, they're neither white nor black. So they cannot go to school here. They already were enrolled, but they dismissed them for that day, but the Gonalum decided to hire a lawyer and file a case. And the case was decided that they were not white, so they could not go to that school. And there really was no place for them to go. They did not want to go to the black school. And of course, some people say, well, they didn't really make a step toward integration, but the way I look at it is they wanted to have the best education for their children. This case went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and of course, this was before Brown versus Board of Education.
So it's one actually recognized as a civil rights case. This is really interesting because when I was teaching in Old Town Elementary School in Albuquerque, one of my co-workers was Rudy Sanchez, and he's Hispanic. And he was taking courses on education for his master's degree. And he actually asked me, he says, you're from Mississippi originally. Do you know anything about the Gonalum case? And I said, well, that's my uncle and my aunt. And he said, well, you don't realize how important that case is. It's a landmark case. And I said, oh, okay. That also helped motivate me to become involved politically and advocate. In our neighborhood, we did have a really multiracial and multi-ethnic neighborhood. We had Jewish people, Lebanese people, African-Americans that were our customers, Native Americans and Mexican customers in our particular neighborhood because our store was close to the levee. And we had, during the time that I was a young person in the store, I grew up there from the time I was born. I was actually born in the living quarters of the store and the first of the six children that are living in our family. And we got along with everybody. And we did have to go to the one-room segregated school at the time that I was growing up until 1947. After World War II was over and Chinese Americans had served in World War II, we were viewed as being patriotic, and we were then allowed to go to school with white children. Unfortunately, the time that I was growing up, well, actually when I graduated from college, then we were not able to teach in the white schools in Mississippi. So that was one of the reasons I left. Not only that, but I, you know, fell in love with my husband and we moved to New Mexico. So
I was born on a farm at Cleveland Crossing, and we had a store, and I've heard stories of the grist mill, mm-hmm. where people would bring their corn, and you'd always grind, but you'd never clean up real well until after they left, because you'd get to keep the leftovers. And that was part of it. People were happy to get their corn ground into meal in a country store. That's a picture. So Frieda's husband is professor at Delta State Accounting. His parents had a grocery store. My parents had a grocery store. I've got a degree. My wife's got a degree. Our children have multiple degrees. And so that story is repeated time and time and time again of the hard work that they put in. And again, the values, the work ethic has carried over. And they were role models for us. They didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. We were role models for our children. We didn't realize it. But now we're being told that mm-hmm. you were role models. We just lived life and we did what our parents did, just in a different way.
Your grandparents and your parents left everything in China.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And gave all of that up, and sometimes even your ancestral identity, because of the 1882 exclusion law. That's what was given up, and willingly, to come over here to do what was most available, which was become merchants, and do that. And so what I see from the outside looking in is that's the spirit they pass on, is not that I expect you to be the most brilliant person in the room, but you do what you have to do in order to be able to make the next step up possible for the next generation.
That's
whatever it is.
A wonderful analogy, because things were hard in China. We didn't ask the question of why, and they might not have been able to say why, because why did Dad come over into New Orleans as a young teenager? Because things were so hard at home. I can't imagine sending my son to a foreign distant land. He probably didn't even have a suitcase.
Yeah.
They came as teenagers. My dad came as a teenager.
And to go by themselves. And then to spend a year in New Orleans when we were down at the Amistad Center at Tulane, Sally and I found records of my dad, Joe T.M., as a student. And I tell the story, he must have been a good student because he was present every day for a year. And that's the extent of his education. That year he spent at the Presbyterian Church school in New Orleans.
Baldwin and his brother Edwin had never been outside of California. They were born there. And they thought, because of Charles, their dad, coming to America when he was a teenager, that they must be the first American-born Chinese in their line. But their dad, he had a picture of the headstone of his dad and his granddad, and it was in English. And so Baldwin just asked him one day, he was like, so if it's in English, where is it? And Charles said, well, it's in Mississippi. And that's all they had to go on. Edwin called the city hall and asked, does anybody know anything about a Chinese grocery store that was in the Delta, somewhere around Cleveland? We don't know the name of the store, but my dad's dad and his granddad died there, and they're buried there, and we want to know more about that. We don't actually archive things under people who die and leave stores. So I thought, good luck, but come on, and sent emails out to people. I remember the board. That's the greatest part about the board, is they're this living, breathing institutional memory of relatives who were connected and how and why and all this kind of thing. So when I got a question like that, I sent it out to everybody I could think of, and you know, we got a couple of leads and thoughts and stuff, but they decided to come to Cleveland just hoping that somebody might know something. Somehow we knew a lot more than we thought we did.
So we have this Baldwin, the grandson, and so brings his father, and they don't know what they're going to find. The father didn't have any memory. He was one, so he really didn't have any memory at all of his real father, just knew that he had come to Mississippi. And so the whole family came to visit the museum because they realized that the family store was in Pace, which is just a little bitty town down the road. And so they come in, and they're seeing the exhibits and everything. And so Charles, who's the father, said something about his father's name is K.C. Lou. And he kept saying, my father's name is K.C. Lou. And Emily over here, in her mind, she said, K.C. Lou? And she said, just a minute. And she goes into her little storeroom, and she pulls out this Bible, and it was K.C. Lou's Bible that he had gotten for graduation. How did you remember that?
I don't know. I mean, literally, I think everything had to be standing right there for it to click, finally. But yeah, it was one of those days where I was just really glad to have come to work. But when the Bible came out, the collection that it had come from was a totally different family. And that's how we realized, okay, well, if K.C. Lou's Bible is in the Dunn family collection, you need to talk to the Dunn family. And that's when the floodgates
the whole
broke
thing
open.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about the Bible, Charles Lou is a Christian. When he realized that his father had a Bible, he thought in his mind that his father is a Christian. And so, as a Christian, he knew that he had a Heavenly Father. And he knew that his father knew the Heavenly Father because he had a Bible. And he knew that he would meet his Father in heaven someday because of that Bible and that tie. But then the Dunn family had acquired the Bible because it was in the store when the grandfather passed away. And so the Bible was in the possession of the Dunn family. And then the Dunn family made the connection. The Dunn family had acquired their store in Pace from Baldwin and Edwin's grandfather. So there's the connection. Kevin Bacon talks about 6 degrees of removal from everybody. In Mississippi, it's about 2 or 3 that you will know somebody that knows somebody.
Charles learned of his dad from all the people who knew him. It's a little outside of yourself, Ellen, to watch a man learn about his own father from everybody else who knew him best. You know, and you just think in your family pod, you are going to know your family better. But because of the situation, because of 1882, and because rules forbade people from coming and going and the freedom, Charles never knew his father. But all these other people have opened up every memory bank they can think of and have told him and let him know his father now. And like Gilroy said, that's why he cries when he holds the Bible. He knows.
Because he thought he was just an abandoned orphan.
But he found out why. One of the things Baldwin found was a letter. It's in the Dunn family, and it was from...
Casey wrote it to Mr. Dunn.
Okay.
And he must have dictated because it was typed. Talks about how much he missed his family. And so Charles was able to hear, see with his own eyes from his father's hand that how much he loved and missed his family.
Thank you so much for talking to us.
Nice to talk with you too,
Kathy. Same here.
Thanks for coming.
This was a presentation of the Preservation Technology Podcast, produced by the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training. To find more podcasts like this one, please visit our website,